Hey, my name is Jason. I'm the producer of It Starts With Attraction. I wanted to let you know that we have a brand new website solely dedicated to working on your pies. Introducing itstartswithattraction.com. You can listen to every episode, learn about the pies, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. Go to itstartswithattraction.com. It starts with attraction, one word, itstartswithattraction.com to get signed up today.
This week on It Starts With Attraction.
If you've ever struggled with your thoughts, and who hasn't, and feeling like your thoughts aren't super helpful to helping you become the kind of person you want to be or achieve the things that you want to achieve, then you don't want to miss this episode. Today, I'm interviewing Jamie Gagnon. Jamie is a licensed mental health counselor in Washington State, and she is certified in Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Plus. In the past, she's done most of her clinical work with teenagers, with kids, in how to help them overcome some of their depressive or anxious presenting symptoms by rewiring their thoughts and having more helpful thoughts through this cognitive behavioral therapy methodology. And now she's talking to us and you and on the It Starts With Attraction podcast about how we can take some of the things that she uses and has used in the past in her clinical settings, and how we can actually use those things in our own lives on a day-to-day basis to help our thoughts become more helpful and to even begin moving forward when we're feeling depressed or when we're feeling anxious. It's a great episode with a wealth of information, so get ready to listen and maybe even take notes. Let's dive into today's episode.
There's a process to falling in love, and it starts with attraction. Join Kimberly Beam Holmes and her special guest as they discuss how to become the most attractive you can be, physically, intellectually, emotionally, and spiritually, or as we refer to it, working on your pies. We'll teach you how to have better relationships and become more attractive to others, and maybe more importantly, to yourself. It starts with attraction, and it starts now.
Jamie, I'm so excited to be talking to you today. Thank you for joining me.
I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. So tell us, our listeners and me, a little bit about your background. How did you get into doing CBT work? What does CBT stand for? All those kinds of things.
Sure. So I got my master's degree in counseling psychology in 2007 from Northwest University in Washington State. And I have a background as a child, adolescent, and family therapist. I've mainly worked in community mental health settings, and I was a clinical supervisor for a school-based mental health program for a couple of years before I came on as a marriage coach with Marriage Helper. While part of my training was through Harborview and University of Washington, they have a program called CBT Plus, which is Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Plus stands for Depression, Anxiety, Behavior, and Trauma. And so I had extensive training, and including consultations and people looking over my work and all of that, plus follow-up trainings in CBT.
Fantastic. What is CBT? If you could give a brief overview, and why do people need it?
Yeah, so CBT is cognitive behavioral therapy. So cognitions are just a fancy name for our thoughts. And it's a way of helping us identify negative thinking patterns and gain control over our thoughts. So learning to see things in a new way. It also helps us identify behaviors that are maladaptive, or another way of thinking of maladaptive is more harmful or less effective behaviors that aren't helping us reach those goals that we want to reach, and replacing them with a more effective behavior.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So when you were working with kids, what were some ways that kids would come in? Like, what were some of the things that they were dealing with? And then you would hear that and say, we need to use some CBT techniques.
Sure. So a lot of the things that I've worked with, I had a lot of kids in foster care, and many of them had backgrounds in trauma and a lot of anxiety and depression. We have a lot of behavioral issues, and sometimes those are ADHD related. Sometimes those are just because of environmental situations. And the way that CBT works is CBT is a skills-based approach. It is about learning tools that you can use on your own, and to challenge those negative and unhelpful thinking and maladaptive behaviors. CBT is also an active therapy. And what we mean by an active therapy is you don't just come and you don't just talk about things. A lot of people think of therapy as you go, you lay down on the couch in the therapist's office and you just talk through things. There is a portion of that that is helpful and there's a portion of that that still happens. But CBT is an active therapy, meaning it's not going to be effective if you aren't taking the tools that you're being taught in session and practicing them on a daily basis outside. So the tools that you are learning in CBT are things that you can do on your own to work to decrease those anxious thinking patterns or those negative thought patterns or changing those negative behaviors that you may have.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So what... just as a, kind of as a side note question. So you said you did CBT plus. When people just do CBT, and you may not know the answer to this, but if they're just doing CBT training, but it's not including the depression, the anxiety, the trauma aspect of it, I mean, it feels like that's going to be the main thing that people come and get cognitive behavioral therapy for. So what is the difference in regular CBT versus CBT plus, and how does someone find... is there a difference in the way that that is the client and how the client experiences the training of the practitioner if they've had one versus the other?
You know, I don't know that I can fully answer that question as I've only had CBT plus training. In grad school, we had training in many different techniques, and CBT was one of the techniques. But I can tell you from what we learn in graduate school, it's not a comprehensive overview. It's more of a brief overview of here's some practical tips. And so for those therapists that are not actively continuing in education to enhance their skills, you're just going to have a brief overview of a lot of different skills. And with CBT plus, this is specifically an evidence-based practice geared towards people working in the community mental health settings. And not, let me backtrack a little bit on that. It's not necessarily geared only towards those in community mental health, but it is the evidence-based practice for the community mental health settings to use. And so my guess the difference would be is in a typical CBT training, you're learning about a lot of the same skills, but in CBT plus, we're really taking it down to when you have a client that comes in with depressive symptoms, this is the pathway that you take them on. When you have a client that comes in with anxious symptoms, this is the pathway you take them on. And we're given a pathway for each of those four areas of anxiety, depression, trauma is called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, has a little different name, and behavior. And so we're given a pathway saying, this is the order that you go through. So for an example, if somebody comes in with depression symptoms, we're going to say, first, we're going to give you some psychoeducation. We're going to teach you about the depression. And then we are going to maybe teach you a couple of coping skills. And then we're going to move into behavioral activation and teaching you different ways of different behavioral patterns and styles that are going to be more effective for you. And it might be looking at things like working on sleep and working on becoming active and different forms of behavior therapy in there. And then we're going to move into cognitive restructuring versus anxiety instead of the behavioral activation where you still do some of that. It's going to be a big focus on exposure work. So there's a little bit difference in the pathways between the different approaches. And I would think that that's maybe the biggest difference between a typical CBT training and CBT plus, but I haven't gone through a typical CBT training, so I can't say for sure.
That makes sense. Okay. So can we do something where I am going to act like your patient?
Okay.
And so let's say I come to you and I don't know that I'm depressed, but you are asking me questions and you find out I'm depressed. What are some of those things you'd be looking for? And again, like, so listen, I want to make sure the listeners understand we are not doing any kind of prescriptive work on this podcast, but this is simply educational to help you as the listener understand, is this something you're dealing with and should you seek further help? But also by the end of this episode, Jamie's hopefully going to share with us some things that you could begin doing. But of course, if you need further professional intervention, we're going to encourage you. We're going to encourage you to get that. But what are, if I were to come to you with the depressive symptoms, what would you be looking for? And then can you kind of walk through more specifics of like that first pillar that you came to? What is one specific thing you would have me do with coping skills? That next one with, I think it was behavioral activation. Like, what does that look like? So let's walk through that for the next couple of minutes. So I come to you, how would you know if I'm depressed?
One thing that you'll see a lot of times when you go into your doctor's office is they're going to hand you what's called a PHQ-9. A PHQ-9 is a patient health questionnaire, and 9 just stands for there's 9 questions on there. So there's 9 key things, and I'll come up with as many off the top of my head as I can remember. Sure. But I'm gonna ask about, how are you sleeping? Are you sleeping too much? Are you sleeping not enough? I'm going to ask about your eating. Are you overeating? Are you eating a lot, or are you not eating enough? I'm going to ask about, are you still interested in things that you used to be interested in? So oftentimes with depression, people will pull away from those things that they like to do. So if they typically are somebody that's like, I like to get out and get active, and I like to go for hikes, and I like to get out there. And I say, so when was the last time you got out and went for a hike? Well, I haven't really wanted to. It's been about 3 or 4 months. That's a sign right there that you're pulling away from those usual activities that you typically like. One of the biggest questions is, do you feel depressed? It doesn't always look like depression, especially in kids. It doesn't always look like feeling sad. Sometimes it can look like feeling irritable. Sometimes it can look like apathy. It can look a little different. It's not always just a feeling of sadness. We would ask, how are your energy levels? Do you have a lot of energy, or are you really low energy? One of the big questions that we're going to ask, and if you go on the PHQ-9, it's going to be the last question on the form, is, are you having any suicidal ideation? Mm-hmm. And we do come out and we ask that very specifically. We don't dance around that. It is, are you having any thoughts of wanting to kill yourself? Because you want a yes or no answer to that. We don't want to be vague around that.
Yeah.
And not everybody that's depressed is going to have suicidal thoughts, but it's an important thing that we have to screen for. So that's not everything that we ask, but that kind of gives you a little idea of that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay, so you've asked me those questions and you determine, hey, cognitive behavioral therapy could work for this. So what would be one of those first coping skills that you may want to work with me on? Mm-hmm.
I always start with deep breathing. I have a lot of people that are just like, oh, Jamie, we hear about deep breathing. It's overly said. But here's the biggest reason why deep breathing is so important, is because it helps physically calm your body down. And we need a way to physically calm our body down. When you think about whether it's depression or anxiety, we feel these emotions in our body. And there's this thing called the sequence of emotion. And when there is a trigger, we automatically think we go from the trigger to the behavior in 0.2 seconds. But in between there is, we first feel it in our body. Then we feel the emotion. Then we have the thought that hits our head. And then we have the action. And all of that is taking place in there. So it's really important to go back and start with body science. So where are you feeling? Where do you feel that feeling of sadness in your body? What are you feeling? A lot of times people will say things like, my muscles are really tight. Maybe their shoulders are pushed up. My stomach is in knots. Maybe my heart's racing. A lot of times that's more of an anxiety symptom. But it could just be, I'm just feeling sluggish. I'm tired. And it's really important to get the blood flowing. To, when we're breathing in oxygen, we're getting enough oxygen in to survive. But when our muscles are all tense, we're not getting the oxygen flow to be able to really think clearly. So we have our prefrontal cortex, which is our thinking brain. And our thinking brain is where we're going to be able to think through those skills that we've learned and different ways to reframe those thoughts that we have. But when we're really tight and tense, we're not thinking as clearly because we're not getting that fresh oxygenated blood to our brain. So it's really important, first and foremost, to start off with, let's calm our body down. And my favorite way is to do a breathing technique. Now, there are hundreds of breathing techniques out there. And I oftentimes will say, find one that works for you, whatever it is that you like. But my favorite is four square breathing. Some people call it box breathing, but it's easy to remember. I've had clients come out of the hospital that will tell me, oh yeah, they taught us 5, 7, 9 breathing. If I, as a therapist, cannot remember the numbers, then how am I supposed to how am I supposed to expect that you'll remember them in the midst of a depressive episode or a panic attack? So I like something that's nice and easy to remember. So four square breathing is essentially you take a deep breath in for a count of four, you hold your breath for a count of four, you let the breath out for a count of four, and you do it four times. You only have to remember one number.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite. The other thing I might talk about is a progressive muscle relaxation to help calm your body down. So progressive muscle relaxation, you can do really long, in-depth ones. You can go on YouTube and find lots of videos where they guide you through them, whether you start at your toes and work your way up to your head, or you start at your head, work your way down to your toes. But you're identifying each individual muscle group and tightening and relaxing. And kind of a good rule of thumb is you tighten for about a count of 10 and you release for a count of 10. You do each muscle group three times. Or if you're in the moment that you're going, Jamie, I don't have time to do 20 minutes of this, then I'm going to use the terminology I use with kids. I'm sure there's a better term to use for adults, but I think it gets the message across. It's called tin soldier wet noodle. So you lock all of your muscles together and you tighten them for 10 seconds as all of your muscles, and then you relax all of your muscles. So tin soldier wet noodle. And And that just helps to get that blood flow circulating too. So that's really where we start, is identifying in our body where we're feeling it and really actively working to calm our body so that we can then think to do the next skills. And that's my favorite place to start.
For someone with depression, when would you encourage them to activate those coping skills? So what is it that you're looking for? Yeah, anxiety, which we'll talk about next, I think that makes sense to when they would use them. What is it for depression?
So with specifically like the relaxation techniques, if you're having trouble falling asleep at night because your brain's going crazy, there's a lot of other things you can do. Like it's helpful to have a pad of paper next to the bed where you can write down all your thoughts and really focus on maybe visualization where you're focused on a relaxing, peaceful place. And all of these techniques can be used for both anxiety or depression. Yeah. But it's really important to be able to relax your body in those moments. Mm-hmm. And so sleep is one where you either tend to sleep too much or you're not sleeping enough when you're depressed. And so if you're having trouble falling asleep at night or you wake in the middle of the night, just really focusing on your breathing, really focusing on relaxing of your body, that's a time when that would be really helpful. Other times could be when you're having to do something you don't want to do, really focusing in on, okay, I'm going to first focus in on just on calming my body. I'm going to just focus in on relaxation before I go out and do the thing I need to do.
Makes total sense. Mm-hmm. Okay. So coping skills, the next one in the depressive model would be behavioral activation. Was that
it? Yeah. So in behavioral activation, specifically for depression, we're going to look at a lot of our pies. Okay. It's so in physical, we're looking at your sleep. How's your sleep? That's one of the most important things that we're going to hit on first. If you aren't getting enough sleep at night, it is going to drastically influence your emotions during the day. And so we're going to focus in on how can we get you having more quality of sleep. Okay. Now, things that you can do to help with sleep are being active during the day. And being active is another big part of behavioral activation. Being active doesn't have to look like going to the gym. Being active can look like doing some stretching in the morning and at night. It can look like going for a walk. It can look like taking your kids to the park and playing with your kids at the park. It can look like making yourself get up and going somewhere when you don't feel like going anywhere. All of that is part of that getting active, right? And so with behavioral activation, we're looking at food. What are you eating? What are you drinking? You know, certain foods are going to make you feel more sluggish and certain foods are going to give you more energy, right? Alcohol is a depressant. It's going to help depress your system when you're already feeling depressed. It's actually not going to help you feel better. It may give you that little buzz in the moment, but it's actually going to make you feel worse overall. Caffeine is a stimulant, but it's going to like give you a little bit of a boost, but then you're going to fall from that. Same with sugar. You're going to get that boost and then you're going to fall. So really paying attention to what you're putting into your body is going to be a big part of that behavioral activation piece.
Love it. Love it.
Now, what I would have to say, behavioral activation is the key component to CBT with depression. It is still important. We're going to talk about cognitive restructuring next, but it's still really important to do those things But the behavioral activation, you're not going to feel like it. You don't want to do it. And we're going to hear this all the time is, well, Jamie, I don't have the energy. I don't have the motivation. I need to have the energy or the motivation before I go do the thing. And the reality is you're not going to feel the behavior of the or you're not going to feel the energy or the motivation beforehand. Yeah. You might get little bursts of energy from time to time, but most of the time you're not going to have that first. And it's just stepping out and doing one step. It's making yourself do something, even though you don't feel like it, because you're not going to feel like it. But that is scientifically proven to be the number one thing to help turn depression around.
Fascinating. I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
Great. What comes after behavioral activation?
It goes into cognitive restructuring. So cognitive, that big word again, just for our thoughts. And it's learning to reframe our thoughts is a more practical way of saying cognitive restructuring. But it's about challenging those unhelpful thoughts that we have and replacing them with a more helpful thought. A lot of people, and in pop psychology, you talk about positive and negative thinking. I really like the terms helpful and unhelpful thinking instead, because I think we have an idea that positive thinking means that we have to be happy. And we're not always going to feel happy. And so I like the term positive or helpful and unhelpful thinking. And so it's taking those unhelpful thoughts that we have, maybe those maladaptive thoughts that we have, and turning them into something that's more helpful. It's maybe challenging the beliefs that we have that are a negative belief pattern. It's taking those automatic negative thoughts that we have that just pop into our head. Because that's another thing. We talk about being able to control your thoughts, and people go, oh, but they just pop into my head. I can't always control that, but it's taking captive that thought. And those automatic negative thoughts that just pop in, are we going to choose to sit and ruminate over those? Or are we going to choose to change the path that they're on and redirect those thoughts to a more helpful thought?
So what would you say would be one of the common or a couple of the common thoughts that someone with depression is typically thinking?
Might be, I'm not good enough. Mm-hmm. Nobody loves me. Nobody wants me. I'm never going to amount to anything. I always mess up. I always screw up. Those are some pretty common ones.
So then let's take one of those. I'm not good enough. So in the cognitive restructuring, how do you go about reframing or thinking about that thought in a better way?
Sure. So it's about having a more helpful response. Sometimes we think we have to do the opposite, but you also have to believe it. And if you're not there to believe it yet, so if somebody might say, well, just tell yourself I am good enough. Well, you can. You can tell yourself I am good enough. And over time, that may be the new path, but you may not believe it at first. And so it really is finding something that is more helpful. And maybe, you know, I have not mastered this skill yet, but I'm still working at it. And over time, I know that I will be good at it. So that would be a helpful reframe, where it's not being stuck in the I'm not good enough. To not everybody is good enough when they start something. And so therefore, the more I work at this, I will be good enough.
Yeah, I like that. I've also heard before, I don't know if this is CBT based, it might be one of those pop psychology things related to CBT, but I've heard before the questions, is it true? Is it really true? Like using those two questions back to back.
Yeah, you can definitely ask yourself those things. And there is a line of thoughts that you can ask yourself with that. Is this a truthful thought? Is this a helpful thought? So something that could be truthful, you know, because maybe it is, I know that we have a lot of people who are in a marriage crisis that listen to your podcast. And with that, it could be, I screwed up so horribly in my conversation with my spouse that I am never going to be able to recover from this. Well, maybe you did screw up really, really bad. So asking yourself, is this true? The answer might be yes. It might be a yes, I did screw up. But then it's, okay, well, what's a more helpful? Is this a helpful thought for me to continue thinking about? And so it is good to ask yourself, is this true or not? Because in some cases, it's not true. You know, if you're telling yourself I'm unlovable because my spouse doesn't love me, it's, well, my kids love me. My mom and dad love me. My friends love me. I am lovable. You know, so that would be a no, that's not a true statement. But sometimes we do things that we beat ourselves up for because they are a true thing. So is it helpful? And what's something that's more helpful for me to think about? I made a mistake and I am capable of doing better next time. So instead of focusing on the mistake that you made, it is, and I am capable of doing better next time.
Yeah. So it's also including that, that it's not just a reframing for in the moment, but how can it be helpful for me to continue to move forward in the future?
Yes.
And it's that self-talk. It's the way that we talk to ourselves that can either keep us stuck or help us begin to move forward.
Absolutely.
Love it. Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Let's cover the anxious pathway. So someone's coming with presenting symptoms of anxiety. So let's start with what are some of the questions you would ask to help identify that? And then some of these are going to be repetitive, but let's just talk about kind of the sequence that you would use and any differences that would happen with presenting symptoms of anxiety.
Mm-hmm. So similar to the PHQ-9 that we have for depression, we have what's called a GAD-7 for anxiety, and that stands for generalized anxiety disorder, and 7 stands for that there's 7 questions. The things that we are looking for is, are you having panic attacks? Is this holding you back from doing things in your life that you would like to be doing that you're not currently able to do? We'd be talking about your intrusive thoughts and the things that the unwanted thoughts that are popping into your head.
Does the GAD-7 ask, it's actually been a hot minute since I've looked at the GAD-7. Mm-hmm. Does it ask anything about physiological presenting factors? Like, are you experiencing racing heart, things like that?
All right. Some of the questions that we are going to ask is just like with the PHQ-9, we're going to ask, are you feeling depressed? We're going to ask them, are you feeling anxious, on edge, are feeling nervous? Sometimes people don't like the word anxiety and it's more, well, I just feel kind of nervous. Mm-hmm. And so that may be the symptom that we're looking at. We're asking them, are you able to stop or control your worrying? We all have worries that pop into our mind, but for some of us, we're able to automatically start applying tools and we're able to control those thoughts versus other times it is hard for us to stop and control the worry that we have. Or are we worrying too much about a lot of different things? So there are specific phobias out there that not all worry is going to be a phobia, but there might be a specific phobia, like arachnophobia is, you know, fear of spiders, right? Mm-hmm. Or claustrophobia is a fear of confined spaces. But generalized anxiety, which is what this form is really kind of asking about, is you might worry about a lot of different things and it might not be the same thing all the time. You might have a lot of different things that pop up that cause you to worry about things. Yeah. So we're asking, we're trying to identify, is it a specific fear that you have or are you worrying about a lot of different things? Do you have trouble relaxing? Most people who are very anxious have a hard time relaxing. So back to those body signs that we were talking about, typically somebody who's anxious is going to tell me that their heart's racing. They might feel hot. They might feel like their stomach is in knots, that their muscles are really clenched. They might feel shaky. Those are all symptoms that I'm looking for when people are talking about body signs that they have with anxiety. Being so restless, it's hard to sit still. So a lot of times people, you can't see my knee, but if my knee is shaking up and down like this, you know, a lot of times people associate that with being very anxious. Some people, it's just a tick that they have, you know, it's just something that they do out of habit. But for some people, that would be, they have a hard time sitting still because they're so anxious in the moment. Being easily annoyed or irritable can actually be a sign of anxiety that I think a lot of people don't realize is part of anxiety as well. Mm-hmm. Or feeling afraid that something bad might happen.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You are explaining my life. I'm sitting here like, check, 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 check. We had a mouse in our house a couple of weeks ago. And talk about the like generalized. So when you're talking about the part of like, it could apply to anything. All the things I was thinking about with this mouse in the house and everything that could happen and go wrong. It was like, yep, my anxiety attached to that stupid mouse for about 2 weeks until it unfortunately passed away in a very appropriate way. But anyway, so someone's coming and this is what they're struggling with. You said there was a different first step after this than what you would have done in depressive. So what's the first step you would take with that person?
It would be exposure. So there's different types of exposure. And this is what's considered the most effective with anxiety. So exposure looks like a couple different ways. Okay. There's systematic desensitization, which mm-hmm. might be, let's say you have a fear of a bridge, okay, or crossing a bridge. It might be you first look at pictures of a bridge and then mm-hmm. while practicing the coping skills that we've already talked about. And then you might go visit a bridge in person, but you don't cross the bridge. Or maybe you start with a little bridge over a creek that's 3 feet long, and yeah. you learn to be comfortable on that before you get to slightly bigger and bigger bridges. And, yeah. and learning to practice the skills that you have to be able to cross that big bridge. Okay. That would be systematic desensitization.
So in talking about the systematic desensitization, mm-hmm. what about when the thought is, or what about when the fear or the anxiety is around something more mental? So what about with hypochondria, for example, mm-hmm. where someone has a fear of something happening to their health? You can't mm-hmm. really expose them to the stressor necessarily, but would you do something like mentally taking them down the road of, okay, so what if you did get cancer? Then what? Like, how would you respond? What would happen? And just mentally have them go down that road until it becomes less fear mm-hmm. producing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So part of that is taking away the fear. So you're breaking down each step of that really as you're going along and talking about, I know the cancer is a hard one because sometimes what the question we're asking is what is the worst thing that can happen in this situation? Well, mm. with cancer, it really is that death is a possibility, right? Mm-hmm. And so it is taking it each step of the way of finding peace with each step of that process. And, mm-hmm. And understanding what the end result may be and learning to find peace within that last part. We're yeah. not going to be taking you through pictures necessarily unless there's maybe a fear of needles in there or a fear of hospitals in there, you know, where we might systematically desensitize to each of those aspects of it. But mm-hmm. it's more about, it's more working through the grief process mm-hmm. than it so much is, I think, the CBT process. There might be other therapists out there that might disagree with me on that piece of it, but it's more working through that grief process of the expectations of what I wanted, the expectations mm-hmm. I want life. You know, I want to live this life. It's working through maybe the five stages of grief, you know, the anger that's there and the denial that's there. And mm-hmm. there might be some bargaining in there too. There might not. You don't necessarily always work through all five stages, but it's getting yourself to that place of acceptance. And so with the fear side of things, it's really about working towards that peace and really working on what are some more helpful thoughts that I can have along this process, and learning still those coping skills. And it's mm-hmm. it's maybe not as much about the exposure side of things.
Gotcha. Okay. So for specific, more known, maybe more tangible anxiety, then systematic desensitization mm-hmm. is a good first step. Is there anything else to add to that one, or do we move on to the second one?
You know, there's also what's called imaginal exposure too. So where you, instead of maybe necessarily going through the systematic desensitization process, you are imagining the exposure in your mind before actually going to a bridge. And you're really mm-hmm. focused on that, calming yourself with just picturing mm-hmm. yourself and using visualization exercises. And so that would be part of the systematic desensitization, or any of it, actually. It's a part of the desensitizing yourself to the anxiety.
Where do you go next?
So flooding would be the other form, where instead of systematically desensitizing yourself to the thing that is causing fear, it's just, if let's say you're claustrophobic, you put somebody into a room with a lot of people all at once. And instead of like showing them pictures of a room of people or mm-hmm. viewing the people from outside, it's okay, we're going to go right into the middle of it and we're going to be right there. It is, somebody has a fear of public speaking, we're going to put you right up front right away. We're not going to wow. practice it. And so that would be the flooding. And There can be some benefits to that too. I prefer the systematic desensitization, but you can't always have that as a process. And so sometimes flooding is also, if For a client, this may be taking too long to get to the point of actually facing the fear. Flooding might be the thing where we're going to put you right in the midst of it. And sometimes, too, you don't have the opportunity to work through the fear prior to it. So you used the example earlier about cancer, and you may not have the opportunity to work through all the anxiety that comes with going to the hospital and needles and all the testing and all of that. You are being thrown into it right away. I would say that for myself, I had a serious phobia of needles when I was younger. When I was 11, it took three people to hold me down to take blood. Wow. And so I couldn't watch needles on TV. I couldn't see needles at all. But something about being pregnant and having to have my blood drawn multiple times over and over and over again, that would be part of that flooding of I'm being forced to be in the situation and experience it without necessarily, I probably could have taken steps to systematically desensitize before. I didn't. And so then it was more of, I have to be a grown-up and I have to do this thing, even though I don't want to. And over time, I still don't like needles at all. But I get allergy shots now weekly, and that helps to desensitize me as well by actually being forced to do the thing that I'm scared of.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. There was a show recently, I don't know if you've heard of it, Limitless with Chris Hemsworth. It was on Disney. And the first episode was him. He has a huge fear of heights. Mm-hmm. And so the first episode was he had 3 days, which kind of, I think, would be flooding, but he had 3 days to get ready to walk out on a beam on like this multiple 100-foot high tower in Australia. And so they did some things where he would like wear the VR headset and act like he was up there. And he did that for a couple of days, but really she focused, the psychologist, I guess he had focused on, how are you going to cope when you're up there? Because you're going to be up there and you're going to walk out there. So let's give you like the breathing techniques and things that you need. I would say, even though they did a couple of things, like it was 3 days, he was basically flooded into it and he walked out there and walked back. So that's what came to my mind when you were talking about those two things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for sure. So after you do that exposure part, then does it go into coping skills, or what is the next part that
so
would
we
come
started
on the
with coping skills? So it starts with coping skills.
Start with coping. Got it.
Yeah. And then to cognitive restructuring again.
Got it. And then
restructuring is just key in all of CBT.
Yeah. Yeah. And then so with anxiety as the presenting symptom, it's going to be, what are the thoughts making you anxious?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's, what are those automatic negative thoughts, or what are those intrusive thoughts coming in? And it is really focusing on reframing those thoughts and restructuring to a more helpful thought, the same way we would with depressive thoughts.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you said that there were a total of 4 pathways. There was one for trauma and one for behavior. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I would love to have you back to do those two in a future episode, because we do not have the time. I would love to allot to those in the time we have left today. But as we wrap up, so what are the things of what we've talked about so far? Would you say, here are some tools you can have in your toolkit to pull out if you're struggling with your thoughts and how they're being unhelpful to you?
Mm-hmm. Sure. The biggest thing is being able to identify, first of all, what is that unhelpful thought that you're having, and then identifying what is a more helpful thought. One of the biggest things is, we tend to ruminate on those unhelpful thoughts over and over in our head. And the more that we do that, it more solidifies that neural pathway. So neural pathways in our brain, you know, we have the triggering thought and then we have the path it goes to. And so it may be, I'm unlovable. Nobody will ever love me. See, your husband doesn't even love you. Your kids are acting out. They don't love you. And the more and more we think about that, the more cemented that neural pathway becomes. And so it really is about consistently finding a different path to go on. And so it is consistently, every time the thought of I'm unlovable pops into your head, it is, I am lovable. My parents love me. I have friends who love me. And it's constantly redirecting that neural pathway. And you can't just do this once or twice. It's not going to work. You have to keep doing it. And over time, that initial neural pathway is going to break down and it's going to form a new neural pathway. And that'll be the primary neural pathway. But I know I'm using big words here, but it'll be the new path that that thought goes down. And so you got to do it though over and over again. And the biggest thing you need to know about learning to change your thoughts is, or even your behaviors, it doesn't happen overnight. You can't try something a handful of times. Sometimes it takes 10, 15, 20 times, maybe even more, depending on how cemented that original neural pathway is before it'll start to break down. But the more you consistently do this, and I'm talking about every time that thought pops up in your head, you don't allow yourself that time to ruminate on it. You change the thought. You constantly are redirecting it. And I like to say, have a go-to thought already in mind. Don't try to reinvent the wheel every time. Have a go-to thought that becomes your new neural pathway that you're going down. And so continuing to go down that path every time that negative thought pops into your head. So it's just continuing to replace that thought with something that's more helpful. And over time, it will become the more permanent thought and the thought that automatically comes to mind. There's, especially with anxiety, we talk about scheduling a time to worry. So sometimes we're in the midst of our day. I can tell you that there have been times in my days when things have not been going right in my life where my mind is filled with all of the things, all of the negative thoughts, all of the unhelpful thoughts, all of the things, and I'm not very productive. And so what I have to do in that moment is say, okay, I don't have time to focus on this right now. But I talk about having your imaginary shelf. If any of my clients are listening in, they've heard me talk about this all the time. Have your shelf and you put that thought up on the shelf. Okay. So what you're doing is it's not saying, can't think about you. I can't see you. I can't. You're saying, I see you. I recognize you. And I'm not forgetting about you. I'm putting you up on my shelf to come back to when I have time and scheduling a time to worry. Now, people look at me crazy all the time when I tell them to schedule a time to worry because it seems really counterproductive. And it's, okay, I don't have time right now to think about you. I see you. You're up on my shelf. I'm not forgetting about you. I'm not trying to ignore you. But I'm going to come back to you. I have time today at 5 p.m. and I'm going to set a timer and I'm going to set a timer for 10 minutes and I will worry about you for 10 minutes. Now, oftentimes, and I hear people tell me this all the time, but Jamie, I get to that time, I don't feel like worrying. Well, that's a good thing.
Great. That's the point, right?
That is a good thing. And it's not about forcing yourself to worry about it if the worry is not there. It's not forcing yourself to think about all the negative thoughts that are and unhelpful thoughts that come around that. It's about going, I don't have time right now. I'm not ignoring you because there's a part of ourselves that needs to be self-soothed. And if we try to ignore that part, it's saying, no, Jamie, something's wrong. I need to do something about this right now. And you can't just ignore it. It's like telling somebody who's anxious, well, just stop worrying. Just stop being anxious. Or somebody who's depressed, just stop being sad.
Right.
It doesn't work. So it's, I see you. I see you up on that shelf and I'm coming back at 5 o'clock to worry about you and to deal with that. And then don't do that more than like 2 times in a week. We're not going to spend a lot of time going back to those worry moments. Other things is identifying our feelings, really identify the feelings that we're having. So we talked about that sequence of emotion briefly, where we talked about you have a triggering event and then you feel it in your body. Well, the next part is our emotions. We're going to feel the emotions before the thoughts come into our head. So really identifying what I am feeling and what can I do with this feeling right now? You had somebody on your episode, I can't remember who it was, that talked about the HALTS acronym. I love to use the HALTS acronym, which stands for hungry, angry, lonely, tired, stress. Yeah. And rating yourself on a scale of 1 to 10. And if you're a female, add a P at the top of that for PMS. And on a scale of 1 to 10. And if you are going, I'm really hungry, okay, go get some food. You know, that's going to affect your emotions. You know, if you're angry, what do you need to do to help cool down? If you're feeling lonely, call a friend. Call, you know, be the friend to others that you want them to be to you. If you're feeling tired, maybe take a nap, work on getting to sleep early that night. If you're feeling stressed, what can you do in the moment to help decrease your stress. It is about identifying your feelings, rating those feelings. So not just in that HALTS acronym, but all feelings. And what do I do to help bring myself down? I guess what I didn't talk about in there was emotion regulation. Emotion regulation is part of the pathway too, but I guess I kind of put that in with coping skills a little bit there. Mm-hmm. And it's also about, it's about doing the things, doing the behaviors that you know are going to be helpful. It's about doing the things that you know are going to help those emotions and be able to regulate those things so that you can move on with your day.
Yeah. A wealth of information, Jamie. Love this. Very practical, tactical things that even though they might not be easy to implement, they are at least we are now aware of some things that we can do when we're having those unhelpful thoughts and how can we replace those thoughts with something more helpful. And I love the idea even too about the unhelpful thoughts, just put them away, allow yourself to think about them at a certain time. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully at that time you don't need to, but these are just real tangible ways that people can begin to implement these things in order to have more helpful thoughts in their lives. I really do want to have you back and talk more about the rest of this. Plus we can get a little bit deeper into some of it, but I have learned from our time together. I've so appreciated your time on with me, Jamie. And, yeah, fantastic. I appreciate you so much.
Thank you so much, Kimberly, for having me.
Here are my key takeaways from today's episode with Jamie. And honestly, it's really hard to just narrow it down to a few because there were so many great tools that she provided to us in our conversation. My first key takeaway is to really think about coping skills. Whether you may be experiencing depression or anxiety, what are the things that you're doing intentionally to help you calm down and get to a place where you can better handle the thoughts and feelings that you're experiencing? It's really difficult to intentionally take hold of those thoughts and take them captive and move them into something more productive when your biology and your physiology is on edge, when you're feeling really anxious or really depressed. So those coping skills can help us to get calm so that we can better introduce some of these other techniques that she talked about. Remember, she talked about the breathing techniques. I can't remember what she called it. I call it the 4x4 box breathing. I think she just called it something with the letter 4 in it or the number 4 in it. But y'all, it's the same premise. It's one of the most effective breathing techniques. You just breathe in for a count of 4, hold it for the count of 4, breathe out for a count of 4, and hold it at the bottom for a count of 4. And doing it 4 times, it takes about 2 minutes to do that. And it's amazing how getting that extra amount of oxygen into our bodies really helps to regulate our system and our biology and even our neurology to help us think a little bit clearer. It's a great first key takeaway. The second key takeaway is behavioral activation. Now, you don't have to remember where this fell, in which kind of pathway she was taking us down. The idea behind behavioral activation is this. There's going to be times we don't feel like doing the things that are best for us, but we need to do them anyway. And this isn't coming from a place of guilt. It's coming from a place of for you to really move forward into being and feeling and thinking in the way that is going to be most helpful to you. What is the first next step you need to take? And focusing on the areas of sleep, of nutrition, of movement are key areas that we can begin to take notice of and begin to make progress in, because all of those areas, those physical areas of our pies, is the area that we have control over. We have control over if we're going to set bedtime at a certain time and try and go to bed at that time. We have control over whether we're going to take that extra alcoholic drink that we probably shouldn't because it's going to mess up our sleep and probably make us feel really crappy too. We have control over what we're going to choose to eat to energize and nourish our bodies. We have control over whether or not we're going to go outside for a short walk or not. Now, you may think of a lot of excuses of why you may or may not have control over it, but at the end of the day, you do. It may look different for every person. It will look different for every person, but how can you put an intentional focus on your pies? and what you're going to do. Now, of course, in this podcast, we talk, not just this episode, but this whole entire podcast of It Starts With Attraction, my whole series, we talk about specific things to do physically, intellectually, emotionally, and spiritually to behaviorally activate and to be your best self in all four of those areas. We won't get into some of those others now, but intellectually is what this podcast is about too. Mentally, taking control of our thoughts so that we can be more present, more engaged, better able to handle what life is throwing at us mentally is another great way to view that intellectual part of our pies. And of course, it's going to have a domino effect into positively affecting our emotional attraction, because when we are focusing on doing what's best for us physically, feeling better, sleeping better, it helps us to emotionally regulate better, which means we are evoking more positive emotions in other people when we are interacting with them. And then, of course, there's the spiritual attraction piece of it, which I actually want to talk about her with us in our next conversation that we have. But that spiritual piece of this, when we're suffering and struggling with our thoughts just overtaking us, for me, and this will be my third key takeaway, for me, one of the greatest things on top of all of these great evidence-based tactics that Jamie and I talked about in this episode, prayer has been so life-giving and mentally relieving to me. And what I mean by that is, in the times where my anxiety is through the roof, for me, because I believe in Jesus and I believe that God is good, even when life is hard, and even in times when it may not honestly be working to my favor, things in life might not be working to my favor or in the way I would want them to for me personally, I can come back to a belief that God is good. And even if I die, I'm going to be with Him. And at the end of the day, this life is fleeting. And so the worst that could happen in many of my anxiety producing situations, the worst that can happen is death. But even if death happens, death has been conquered. And Jesus is on the other side of that. He's on this side and He's on that side. And that for me is so comforting. Even when life situations right now that don't even have to do with death are hard and difficult, relationships failing, all of those things, I can go back to a truth that God has never left me. And in times I feel like He has, it wasn't Him who moved, it was me. And so there's a faith aspect for me that has helped my anxiety, because at the end of the day, if I'm trusting in myself, my anxiety is high because I will never be able to provide or fulfill in any of those ways. But I can trust that God loves me. And that at the end of the day, even if my life doesn't look the way that I thought it would, that God is good and He does good. And some of the things I'm worried about are things that in the end of the day don't even matter. And for me, when I've gone through seasons of my life where my faith has been tested and I haven't trusted in God, that's when my anxiety has been debilitating. But it's been when I really just give it all to God, pray about it, and don't, even if things haven't been fixed, even if I'm not asking Him to fix it sometimes, if I can just trust that He's going to handle it, whatever that looks like, and take my hands off of the control panel of the situation, that's ironically when my anxiety seems to go down. Hopefully that's helpful for you. If you have found this episode to be helpful, share it with a friend. Leave a 5-star review if you love it, or any review. We would love for you to review this podcast in Apple and Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps the podcast to reach even more people, and it's one of the best ways that you can support this show. Until next week, stay strong.